Welcome to Reality Bites on, I suppose it's April Fool's Day in this side of the water. I have a guest I've been on before, James Corbett, live from Japan. What's the time there, James? 9 a.m. in the morning or something?
9 a.m. bang on the dot.
Okay. It's not your latest video now at this stage, but a few days ago you posted a video regarding the solutions to the current kind of financial system, if you like. To call it that, the control system, whatever, regarding peer-to-peer and the kind of opportunities and inventions, if you like, which are springing up all over the place, right across the board in many kind of industries, entrepreneurs just coming up with applications for the phones or whatever it is. But this is to counter, of course, the whole global financial system, which is crushing us all. And just recently in Greece, of course, I wrote a little piece the other day there regarding Greece and the supposed anti-austerity government caving into the IMF and all the rest of it and deciding to sell off all their assets and tax the people even more into austerity. And I have a colleague in Greece, actually, who I've stayed with a number of times, who's got a small hotel on one of the islands down there. I won't say what it is, but a little hotel. And basically, his day... This is 7 days a week during the summer season, which can last about 8 months. He starts at 6 o'clock in the morning in his little kind of bed and breakfast guest house. He gets up, he does the breakfast, he serves the breakfast, he cleans up afterwards, he goes around, does all the rooms, all the rest of it. Then there's about 2 hours sleep, gets up, does the evening kind of session, the meals and stuff. And then he has to clean all that up, go down to a local restaurant and work until about 3 o'clock in the morning. And all he says he's doing is paying taxes. That's all he's managing to do. And that's as a direct consequence of the austerity package right across Europe. And Greece being this big experiment, I think. And I don't know how far they expect to push them. I mean, Greece is no stranger to military rule. And who knows what will happen there. But that's the situation in Greece for just ordinary people anyway. And as you say, this is... In your video, you start off by, I suppose, quantifying, if you like, what the financial system is and how it controls things. And, of course, you mentioned the IMF, and they're infamous for what they call the IMF riot. And that's exactly what we've seen in Greece over the past few years and in a few other countries as well. So I suppose to start off, we should really kind of broadly look over what the financial system is that runs the world and how it works.
Well, yeah, we should be able to clean that off in a minute or two. Well, I think there's a couple of things that are important to note from what you just said there. And one of them is that I don't think it's the global aspect of this globalist agenda that is the problem. National boundaries are just lines on a map, and I don't think they should apply to free human beings. But unfortunately, that's the system we live in. But it's not the global aspect of it that's bad. It's the fact that it's a centralized bureaucratic system, which has been created expressly so that a few people at the very top can control vast amounts of people and resources at the bottom. And that is, of course, just an extension of the way that society has been ordered for thousands of years now in almost every civilization. The pyramid structure has been kind of the idea behind most governmental structures since the beginning of human history, and that's why it's such a profound and powerful image that has been used for a long time to represent that. So in this age, what we have is the type of centralization and now a globalized centralized bureaucracy, which was really unimaginable in previous generations for all sorts of technical and logistic reasons, that is finally coming into view. And this is the end result, as I say, of really centuries, if not millennia, of attempts to bring this about. And so now we have these institutions like the IMF, like the World Bank, like the European Union, like these trade pacts that are starting to go in behind the scenes, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership or its Atlantic counterpart, or the World Trade Organization, or the World Health Organization and the United Nations, and all of these different institutions, which are really centralizing power in the hands of fewer and fewer people. And that power, of course, is getting further and further away from the grasp of of the average person. And that is, I think, perfectly represented and reflected in what you're saying there with regards to what's happening in Greece. That's kind of the logical extension and outcome of this, that eventually you get to the point where a few kleptocrats at the top of that pyramid can basically steal and siphon off the lifeblood of the millions of people at the bottom, and then they end up getting holding the bag when the piper needs to be paid. So that is, I think, the image of the system that we're being sort of slotted into. And opposed to that, or at least one thing that we can put in opposition to that, that I posited in that recent podcast episode you're talking about, is the peer-to-peer economy. And that might be a problematic term. I didn't invent the term. I didn't coin it. It's been used by a lot of other people in different contexts. And there's a lot of different aspects to this that all have their own terminology, and some of these ideas overlap, and some of them are contradictory, and some of them are unhappy with the others. But you may have heard of the sharing economy, or collaborative consumption, or peer production. All of these are different aspects of what is now possible because of the technological advances that have been made, especially in the last decade or two, to really connect people online one-to-one, directly to each other, which is extremely important for the idea of getting around those centralized institutions of control. Because how else could we possibly imagine us ordering an economy on even a regional scale or a national scale, let alone an international global scale, without those types of centralized bureaucracies? Well, this is the way that we can do it, through peer-to-peer connection. And for people who don't know what peer-to-peer means, basically a peer-to-peer network is one in which there is no centralized server from which all of the information of the network, or through which all the information in the network is being passed. Instead, people connect to each other directly through the network, and you can connect to any node on that network, either directly or through other nodes, and you can exchange information directly. And that, of course, is an idea that I think a lot of people will be familiar with in the music downloading arena, where, of course, Napster was probably the first peer-to-peer software application that really penetrated the public consciousness. But obviously it's much, much more than that. It's the idea now that people can literally directly connect with each other. And I posited in that podcast episode that this technological development is, I think, perhaps similar to what happened in 18th, 19th century England, America, other places around the world, the Industrial Revolution, where you had the steam engine and new processes for plowing fields, and the spinning jenny, and all of these types of technological developments that led to a reordering of society. And I think that's what we're seeing right now with the peer-to-peer economy and all of the possibilities that it opens up. But as always, the question is whether or not this very exciting and very promising and very hopeful development can and will be steered into just another form of centralized bureaucratic control.
Well, I suppose if we look at it in its most basic form, outside the world of electronics, if you like, the internet, it's basically the two men meet in the street, one's got a bag of carrots and one's got a bag of potatoes, and they hand them over. There's no money exchange. That's, you know, it's a fair trade. It's, you know, one guy gets the potatoes he wants and one guy gets the carrots he wants. And there is no monetary exchange to that. But of course, with the advent of technology and the rapid ascent of technology to basically impact all of our lives, endless possibilities open up. But I suppose the only thing that worries me about it really is who controls the power to run it. I mean, in terms of power, I mean, the electricity, the infrastructure. I mean, I don't know how that's done.
That is one of the aspects of this, because as people are all too familiar with these days, of course, the internet is tracked and surveilled to an incredible degree by the NSA and its fellow organizations around the world. So absolutely, the internet itself, the infrastructure upon which a lot of this information is passed, is in one way, in one sense or another, controlled in some manner, and is becoming more and more controlled as various different censorship techniques are being applied in more and more countries. So that is absolutely a concern. But there is also a peer-to-peer solution to that problem, interestingly. I did a podcast a year or two ago on the idea of pirate internet, or the term is escaping me now, networks that basically operate on a peer-to-peer fashion, but are provide a type of internet type network. And this can be done either through one person has an internet connection, and then they share it with those around them, and they share it with those around them, and you can develop a network that way. Or more fundamentally, I think the ultimate idea would be to actually create a network that is actually not connected to the internet. It's just a network of people sharing their internet connections in their local vicinity and linking those up. And that sounds kind of crazy or like a pipe dream, but that's actually been implemented in several places around the world. And I don't have the examples to hand, but I know in France, for example, at Occupy Wall Street, they were even doing some of that mesh networking is what it's called. So people can look up mesh networks. So there are even peer-to-peer alternatives to the internet itself. So this can be done. Again, it's just a question of the way that this is either harnessed and people realize how important this technology is, or whether it's just dismissed as, oh, that's never going to work, so we might as well continue to go along with the status quo. And I think, I don't know if this is going to be the transformation that will ultimately cast off the oligarchs from society, but I do know if we don't try, at least try to make something of this, then that casting off will never occur. So I just like people to at least think about this. And it's not even something that we have to speculate on. It is happening right now. And I gave a couple of dozen examples in that podcast episode of things that are happening right now that are examples of this phenomenon, from the seemingly mundane, like couch surfing or ride sharing or those types of things, to things that I think are much more potentially revolutionary, like the 3D printing revolution, for example. The fact that people now can literally manufacture goods on their desktop, and those goods can be garnered from blueprints that they download online from open source communities. We can literally share the blueprints for creating things in the real world and then create them on our desktop. That is an exceptionally, extremely important part of the process of really deconstructing the industrial era society that where everyone has to congregate in factories somewhere in order to produce anything. We're now getting towards the point where we can produce things individually, and we can share the designs for that anywhere around the world. And again, this isn't theoretical. This is already happening in even downloadable cars. There was the old ad, you wouldn't download a car, would you? Well, actually, you can download a car these days. There's things like OS Vehicle or Local Motors or different examples of this, where communities come together and design open source blueprints for actual roadworthy vehicles that you can then download. And if you had the parts, you could assemble it yourself, or you can purchase the parts, or you can even purchase it pre-assembled if you want. But still, the idea is there that this is already happening. So again, it can be very small and very mundane, but there are also some very big ideas that are going to be fundamentally disruptive to the economy as we know it, and more so as the technology develops. I mean, right now, 3D printing is really in its infancy and only able to do some very crude types of things. But as it becomes more and more developed, and you get multiple materials and you can work with putting them together in more complex ways, soon we will be able to replace a lot of the things that we have lying around the house, literally at home on our desktop. And I think that is such an important part of the way that the economy is going to be structured in the future. I don't think it's a question of whether this will happen. I really do think it's just which way it's going to be harnessed. Again, we can imagine a future in which this is all heavily policed through very controlled and censored internet that has stringent copyright protection, so nobody can share anything in a collaborative community or that type of nightmare scenario. Or we could imagine people grasping and embracing and using this technology right now. And it's, as you say, it's not just a technological phenomenon. I think the technology is helping to make this possible, but this is an idea that really does, at the basic level, break down to two people exchanging things directly with each other without a middleman. And if you can get rid of the middleman that is the central bank that issues the fiat paper funny money that we take for money in our society, all the better. And again, that type of thing is happening more and more online, especially in what's called the sharing economy, where basically, does everyone on your block need to own a stepladder? Probably not, because you only use it for a couple of hours a month, if that. And so you share it around with your neighbors. Well, how do you coordinate that? It's exceptionally easy to do with the types of technology that exists now. And there are many websites online right now where you can share all sorts of things with your neighbors and community organizations. So I think the most important aspect of this is what it's going to do to our sense of community and the society itself. Because just as the Industrial Revolution made it necessary for people to congregate in cities and work together in factories and then go home at night and just basically vegetate in front of a television, I think this technology potentially, again, potentially empowers people to organize in a different way where it doesn't matter where you live. You can still do your work because your work can be facilitated from anywhere on the planet. You can participate in communities of interest. And of course, that facilitates actual human connection more so than the type of divided and conquered society that we're living in today. All of these possibilities come about as a result of the fundamental underlying change that's happening in the economy.
Yeah, I just wanted to get the infrastructure thing out of the way at the start, so because people will say, well, how's this going to work without the infrastructure? So you've answered that these kind of projects are already underway and in some cases working. The thing about the 3D printing, I guess, is, I mean, it cuts out the whole argument about getting a patent and all the rest of it. If people are doing it for the right reasons, somebody invents something that can, something for your garden, say some kind of tool that will help you do your gardening or whatever, and you can print out the blueprints at home or print the thing actually in reality, and that takes out a whole range of bureaucracies.
It really does. And again, let's try to direct people to actual sources of this so they can look at it for themselves, because it is already happening. For example, if you go to opensourceecology.org, you can download all sorts of blueprints for various types of farm machinery. I mean, this already exists. As a farmer, you can now build your own tractor or whatever, you might need through these design blueprints that are available for free download. They are already happening. These types of communities are already forming. So it is already starting to transform the economy in ways that I think a lot of people and a lot of talking heads either don't see or don't want people to see, because obviously we have to be kept in that mindset that, oh, the only possible way to structure our society is through these globalist, centralized, bureaucratic systems of control with a very few people at the very top making all the decisions for everyone. The idea that we can actually collaborate directly with each other and share ideas directly, that's absolute anathema to the power structure. And obviously so, because that's the exact opposite of the vision of society that they have in store.
Yeah, I mean, I started off talking about potatoes and carrots, and you brought up farmers. Take that to its logical conclusion. The farmer needs a new tractor, and he knows somebody who does the blueprints. He also knows somebody who's got the technical ability and machinery to make the parts. He puts out his request for a tractor of whatever specification he wants. He has the guy who can make the parts and put it together, or maybe that's somebody else. He's going to offer them, a year's supply of food or whatever to do that type of thing. Again, there's no money changing hands. And it's quite simple in its concept. It just takes people to kind of believe it and to trust each other, which I think is that's a big issue in terms of the money system. We've all been taught not to trust each other. You don't trust the secondhand car salesman or the plumber or whatever, because they're all going to rip you off. That kind of concept. It brings people together on a, there's a mutual benefit to both, and it's not money. It's something they actually want, need.
That's exactly right. And again, I think these developments are potentially transformative of what we understand the economy to be, because of course in our day and age and in the industrial society that we're just growing out of right now, it has been structured along those lines of just trying to get dollars and cents so that you can be secure in buying whatever material goods you need. We are moving towards a different idea of how to conceive and how to structure our economy, which doesn't rely on that method as much. I think there will still be a place for that, but there is now such things as collaborative consumption, which I was talking about earlier, the sharing economy, that you can share goods with your neighbors in ways that are easier than ever, and which is a win-win in every possible way that you can look at it. I mean, when you look at the idea that basically all these the sort of unused productive capacity of the economy that we have, all of these pieces of machinery and tools and things that we have lying around that we're not using 99.9% of the time, well, instead of everyone buying them, well, we can just actually share and use them together. That is such a transformative idea. And it, of course, it cuts down on waste. It cuts down on all of the excess sort of consumption in the society that's unnecessary, all of these things. And of course, this is, again, going to be anathema to those, you know, factories that produce tools that, or whatever the case may be, that, you know, well, we rely on people buying stuff they don't need. Well, we are really trying to move out of that right now. And I think the society as a whole understands that needs to happen at some point. But how do you do that within our current system? It's structured to make that very difficult to do. But again, this idea of collaborative consumption, the sharing economy, peer production really does transform that and makes it so that really community is the important part of the equation, not the dollars and cents or whatever is used to facilitate the trade, but the community itself becomes more important. And I think that's the real danger in moving towards this era of peer-to-peer economy, is that we might put the cart before the horse and think of this as an economic phenomenon before we think of it as a community phenomenon. That's why I advocate, and that's why I put in the podcast episode, the stress at the end of the episode, that it's about building community and community organizations and fostering relations with those around us. It should be the absolute first part of this before we move into these types of collaborative consumption and sharing economy models. Because without that sense of community, without having established community with our neighbors, then it is, as you say, I don't trust him. You know, what's he trying to get from me? Why would I participate in this? What do I get out of it? It's not until we start seeing ourselves as members of these communities and start participating in them and start forming the organizations with like-minded people around us that we will start to see the real value of this and avoid those pitfalls that you talked about earlier about the potential for this to be censored or controlled or manipulated in various ways, which of course can and does and already has happened. I mean, you look at an idea like eBay. Again, that's a transformative idea. That's part of this peer-to-peer economy idea. People, again, facilitating direct exchanges, basically auctions with each other on a global scale. That's a pretty transformative idea. But then look at eBay itself and its ownership and its collaboration with the NSA and the fact that it's so controlled and has basically just become a part of the establishment structure. Well, that's obviously problematic. And then what eBay spins off PayPal, and which of course is again another, you know, great idea. Oh, we can send money instantly around the world without the need to go to, you know, Western Union or whatever. But no, of course, PayPal is also with the NSA and collaborates with the various governments for tax structures and all of this. So these types of ideas can, of course, like anything else, be co-opted. Any individual example of this phenomenon could be co-opted and used for destructive purposes. But I don't think that's the point. The point is that we need to be creating these ourselves. We need to be creating these types of institutions ourselves and using them directly. The ones that we participate in, the ones that we know are free from that type of control. And if we suspect that type of control, we should create other ideas. I hope that the genie is out of the bottle on this, and there's no way they're going to stuff that cork back in the bottle. But again, it depends on people actually making use of this and actually taking the initiative to start creating communities and start creating some of these, implementing some of these ideas in their own community. If people don't, and if they just go along with the status quo, then eventually it will all congeal into a, you know, PayPal slash eBay slash Google slash Microsoft, whatever, controlled society where all of these wonderful ideas are just, again, part of the establishment centralized bureaucratic control grid.
Yeah, I studied a little bit of economics when I was at college and university, and I think it was something called opportunity cost, I think it was, and that related to, you know, you would pay the price for something which gave you a level of satisfaction. That was as far as you were going, and that was the opportunity cost. If you didn't pay that money, you lost the opportunity, kind of thing, to have that satisfaction, if you like. And it's in terms of this, without the money aspect of it, the satisfaction. I mean, you may give something slightly more valuable than the person gives to you in return, maybe down the road, 2-3 weeks down the road when you need something from them. But the fact is, you've helped somebody out. You're not trying to get one over on them. I think one of your examples was there was a work group, and they got together on a Saturday or something, maybe 10 or 20 volunteers, and they looked at what people needed done, whether it was they needed their their garden tidied up or something, or they needed something built, maybe old people or something couldn't do it themselves, and they just all got together and did it for free. You know, and that's the satisfaction of it. That's the opportunity cost, if you like. You're doing that piece of work for somebody because you want to do it and you want to help them out. You want them to, you know, have a better life through it. And as you say, build the community that way, rather than haggling over a few pounds and pence and, this is going to cost a little bit extra because I've had to do it differently.
Well, that's the point. I mean, that's the fundamental point of the economy. And I think that's the thing that we really lost in the transition from the pre-industrial society to industrial society. Because in the industrial society, as we say, you basically get herded into a city so that you can congregate near the center of production. And I suppose in the 19th century context, that would have been a factory of some sort. But in this context, maybe it's just sitting in an office in a cubicle like millions and millions of other drones. And that's basically the way that we structure our lives, and everything is structured around that. So, of course, you have the suburban dwellings where people will try to get away from that urban environment, so they move slightly out of the city, and of course that requires that they're going to have to buy a car, and of course that means they're going to have to buy oil or gas, which of course is going to come from one of the oligarchical institutions that have been controlled by the Rockefellers and their ilk for a century and a half. Or what are really the alternatives there? I guess you could live in a highly urban environment in a tiny apartment, a cramped, overpriced apartment, completely segregated from your neighbors, not knowing their names, not interacting with them in any way. And of course, we have all this wonderful gadget and technology, which basically drives us apart more than it drives us together. Of course, you can find people online that you might collaborate and communicate with, but it just tends to wrench you away from people who are actually physically around you. And so this is, of course, quite different from the pre-industrial society, which was structured on community economy. If you were a cobbler or a blacksmith or what have you, you are, of course, going to be serving those people in your community. So you have to know those people in your community. You have to have a relationship of some sort with those people in your community. It's actually important for you as a person in that economy to actually have relationships with those around you. And I think, again, this is the idea that we could be grasping in this alternate model for how we can structure our economy these days, is the idea that it's going to depend on actually people around you and sharing and collaborating and cooperating with those around you. And hey, there may be economic transactions that take place there as well. But I think the underlying point has to be the community itself. And fostering that sense of community is going to be difficult because it's something that has been, I think, engineered out of us for generations and generations. We tend to think of ourselves as atomized individuals who are completely against, you know, pitted against everyone else in some sort of competition for those pieces of paper or those little bits of coins, which we think of as money. And that is the silent third partner in any transaction that happens in our current economy, is the central bank that controls the issue of that currency. And again, if we can eliminate that, and there are ways to eliminate that, including all the various versions of cryptocurrency that are coming along, peer-to-peer currency itself, which eliminates the central banks from the equation. Again, there's so many different ways to do this, but it's becoming easier than ever. I mean, that's I think the point. There's a tipping point at which this becomes extremely easy to do, and all people have to do is start participating in it. And I, again, it's just such a overwhelming idea that I hope people can at least see the forest for all the trees, because people tend to concentrate on the trees. Oh, I don't like the idea of this particular example of the peer-to-peer economy, therefore it's a stupid idea. I think we have to get beyond that and see the bigger societal, civilization-wide change that's taking place right now, and whether we're going to steer that in a good direction or allow it to be subsumed by the status quo.
Yeah. I mean, of course, in any kind of economic model, there's going to be success and failure. So, I mean, some of the peer-to-peer ideas might not work. I mean, you know, and some of them will. That's just the way it is. Some will be successful, some won't. But I mean, even the term peer-to-peer, it means you're dealing with people like yourself, like-minded people who have the same enthusiasm for what you're trying to do, and, you know, presumably some similarities of belief system. It doesn't, you know, not religious or anything, but you believe that something has to be done to withdraw from the system we're in to make our lives better.
Exactly right. And I don't want to come across as someone who's just talking about this, you know, out of his bottom. I mean, I'm talking about this from my own experience. I am a peer-to-peer funded journalist. I mean, there are people out there who literally, I'm blessed to have a following who will subscribe to my website or donate or purchase DVDs that literally make it possible for me to do this work. And that is something that would have been technically, I guess, theoretically, somehow or other possible in previous generations, but it is really in our grasp now to start doing this. And think about the changes that brings about in something like the reporting of news. I mean, in any other era of mass media history, at any rate, in order to do what I'm doing now, to speak to millions of people around the globe, I would have had to have been a part of some sort of corporate entity, you know, in one way or another, going through the publishers and editors of some vast, you know, oligarchical system of corporate control in order to get my message out to other people. And there's no way I would have gotten the message of 9/11 truth or anything of that sort out to millions of people as I have done through what I'm doing right now online, through this peer-to-peer exchange of information that's happening right now. And I'm supported directly by the people who are listening and viewing what I do. That is a transformative model. We don't need that third party in the middle gatekeeping what goes through, because of course that third party is always going to be representative of the oligarchical interests that want to clamp down on this exchange of information. So I'm not just talking about this peer-to-peer economy as an abstract. I am literally living, breathing proof that it can, at this point in time, it is possible, it is something, we can get something out of it. And I'm not saying I'm the be-all and end-all of this, but I'm just saying it really is working right now for some people in some ways, and we really have to grasp it, and I think push it through to a conclusion that we all want, rather than the kind of conclusion they want to steer it towards, which is back towards those gatekeepers trying to tell people what can and cannot be passed around.
Yeah, well, if you know, I've never met anybody who hasn't admitted to actually, you know, wanting to be paid for what they enjoy doing. Now, I mean, peer-to-peer gives them that kind of opportunity, whether it's journalism, whether it's arts, whether it's anything, you know, manufacturing things, something they've got an interest in, some kind of hobby or skill they have, but they actually enjoy doing it, you know. This opens all kinds of doors without that need to do the 9-to-5 thing, go into the office and then come back at night and try and do it, you know. I mean, yourself, I believe you were a teacher in Japan, was it?
And that's right, yeah.
And you had to do what you're doing now at the same time, much the same as most people, I think, in the so-called alternative media or whatever. We all try and balance it out with what else is going on in our lives. But to be able to actually do something that you enjoy doing, and being able to survive, not, you know, nobody's interested. Well, I'm sure you're not interested in becoming a millionaire through this or, you know, anything like that, but just to survive doing this is an achievement in itself.
It really is. And again, this is possible now. And I think this brings us back to that idea that the society, the economy used to rely on artists and craftsmen who actually cared about what they were doing more so than I think people who care about whatever kind of assembly line they're working on, or whether that be in the office context, sitting there at a computer all day, you know, typing information into a spreadsheet or whatever people might be doing. We've been so detached from the product of our labor over the course of the last few centuries because of this industrialization and this process that has come in to basically detach people from their work. And as you say, this is the chance to reattach people to the work that they actually want to do. And whether that is you play guitar and you want to spread your music around, never been easier in the history of humanity to do so. If you're a designer and you want to spread your designs around, again, never been easier in the history of humanity to do so. If you have the gift of the gab and you want to talk to people in a sort of societal conversation, start a podcast. If you want to, if you simply just have room in your house and want to meet other people who are traveling through, hey, why don't you start a couch surfing thing so you can share that with people or rent it out to people. Again, there's so many different ways that this can happen, and it's the possibility of it. Once again, I keep coming back to this because I know that it's for a lot of people who are incredulous that this can possibly you know, how is this ever going to work out, or it's going to be controlled, or we can't trust this or that organization. I just hope that people see the bigger picture here, because there is a bigger picture that is developing right now. And again, people like myself are living, breathing examples of that.
Well, I mean, of course, people believe in the current financial system. So it's all a matter of belief, isn't it, that something's going to work properly.
Yeah.
And it must be obvious to anybody across the world that the current system doesn't work. It's boom, bust, crash, whatever, you know, consistently. It's never stable. It brings misery upon misery for billions of people across the world. And if people want to get out of it, you know, they have to kind of take a step back and look at it and say, well, do I really want this for my children? Do I want them going through the same thing, losing their homes and, you know, becoming homeless, starving, end up in some kind of, you know, camp or whatever? Because that's the obvious conclusion you've got to come to with the amount of people that are getting thrown out of their homes at the moment. You'll have to look at the amount of foreclosures in the US. I mean, I don't know where these people have gone, all these people that lost their homes, you know. But going back to the work party that did the thing on a Saturday, I mean, even in the UK, there are so many builders out of work, skilled tradesmen, bricklayers, electricians, whatever. There's a thing right away, right across the country. You know, you need a plumber in Edinburgh, or you need a bricklayer in, you know, Birmingham. You know, what does this guy get from you? Well, he needs a plumber. He's only a bricklayer. He doesn't know how to do plumbing. That kind of thing. And they just exchange their trades and get on with it. Never mind the money side of it.
Exactly. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And for people who don't know or haven't seen the podcast, we're referring to the Ozarks Neighborly Exchange, which is just a tiny community organization in a tiny community in Ozark County, Missouri, that I think is just one example of, I'm sure, a million that are taking place around the globe. But in this community organization, as you say, every month they organize a work party of some sort. So some member of the community will say, oh, you know, I need a new fence built for my property or whatever it is. And the people will organize, come together, get the materials, and go and, you know, do that project for that month. And it could be something as simple as that, which helps to foster that community environment that breaks down those barriers that we've erected around ourselves and around and between each other, and makes everyone see each other as competitors rather than as potential collaborators. And this is the type of organization that I think is going to be the thing that will see people through the other side of that austerity breakdown process that we're living through. Because unfortunately, the way the system is structured currently, the austerity, painful, rioting, people unemployed, misery that is being inflicted on more and more people in the industrialized world, let alone the developing world, is to the advantage, to the benefit of the oligarchs who want to centralize control, because they will always be able to come in and say, oh, look, everything's breaking down. We need more power in order to save you. So the European Central Bank will start to argue, well, we can't let each individual at European country, you know, run their own economy. We're going to need more control over that. And the inevitable end result of that process is just the consolidation of more and more control in more centralized locations. And eventually, once you have Europe completely under the control of the EU, then it's just a question of merging the EU with the Asian Union and the African Union and the North American Union and whatever else it starts to come together. And I think we all know where that process leads to in the end. It's to having a very few people at the very top controlling the entirety of the globe. I mean, that's something that is at least feasible and a logical development of the process we see taking place, where every time something fails, every time there's a crash, the centralized powers systems get more and more power. But if we have these types of community organizations where we can literally start collaborating and helping each other directly without the need for that central bank middleman with the phony fiat pieces of paper funny money, then we really are starting to free ourselves from that system. That is the real meaning of independence, to be independent of those systems of control that say, just give us your allegiance, your life, your, you know, sign away your sovereignty, and we'll take care of you. And I understand why that's an appealing idea for a lot of people, and a lot of people end up going along with it, because it has served a lot of people well enough for most of their lives, and they can't imagine any other way of doing it, which is why we have to break through that conditioning and point to the examples where we see them, even tiny little community organizations like the Ozarks Neighborly Exchange, as the type of thing that can be implemented anywhere in the world by any group of people who come together for the reasons that we've talked about, the idea of subverting this process and starting to really form and foster those communities.
Yeah, of course. I mean, of course, this could be done in one street, you know, maybe only have 20 or 30 houses, but it could be done in one street on that kind of basis. And then, you know, street by street, as more people get to know about it. I've no doubt this will take off in a number of places similar to the Ozark thing, because it works and people can see it works. As it kind of develops, in terms of, I suppose the Ozark thing is possibly the most kind of in your face thing. You can actually physically see people doing things rather than the online stuff. How are the authorities, so if you want to call them that,
the self-claimed authorities? Yeah.
Yeah. How do you think they're going to react if this kind of spreads like wildfire? I mean, I don't see that they can really do anything.
Ultimately, I think not. Not if enough people participate in it. But to be fair, I mean, this isn't a straight line, as I said in the episode. It's not a straight line from A to Z. I think there's a lot of pitfalls along the way, a lot of ways that this can be diverted, controlled, subverted, co-opted. I mean, one example is the co-opting these ideas. So taking an idea like an eBay type idea and then making it into eBay itself and then controlling eBay through its ties to the government and the NSA and all of this behind the scenes is one way that this phenomenon can be subverted. So control the organizations by subverting them, co-opting them, centralizing them, and putting them in the back pocket of the so-called would-be authorities. Of course, there's legislation that they can come out with. They can say anything that they want is illegal. There's municipalities around the United States that have tried to claim that collecting rainwater is illegal. Feeding the homeless has been declared illegal in various cities in different times. And that's why so many people always say when you present them with these types of ideas, oh yeah, but you know, if this ever took off, they'd just clamp down on it. Well, yes, they would attempt to clamp down on it, absolutely, and they already are in various ways. They'll try to ban raw milk and things of that nature. But the point with those types of legislation, with the bans and things like that, is, well, yes, if you just roll over and go along with it, I suppose that is the end of the story. But that isn't the way that it has to go. And in fact, we have specific examples of that. There was, I believe it was a city in Florida that tried to ban feeding the homeless. So a group organized a mass feeding of the homeless as a direct violation of that would-be ordinance. And eventually the courts ruled it down and ruled in the favor of the people doing this. And now it's no longer illegal to feed the homeless in that city. I mean, so these types of fights will happen. There will be kickback and there will be, it will not be an easy road at all times. But the more that this is done, I mean, it is a muscle. The more it is flexed, the more it has worked, the bigger it will grow. And the more people participate in this, the more impossible it will be to clamp down on it. Even the most brainwashed of police officers will still have qualms about fulfilling arrest quotas for community organizations that are gathering to help each other out and things of that nature. At a certain point, when that becomes a real cultural phenomenon, I really do think it is unstoppable. And of course, the authority exists in the head of those people who believe in the authority. So once we start showing that that authority is Wizard of Oz curtain magic, and we start showing that the real power of society is ourselves working together collaboratively, once that starts to happen, once that change in consciousness occurs, I think there's no going back from that point. And it's just a question of pushing this through to the conclusion that we want.
Yeah, I think that case in Florida was a World War II veteran actually started that off. He'd been arrested a couple of times for doing the same thing, feeding the homeless. And because he was a World War II veteran, I think he was in his late 80s or early 90s, and he was still doing this kind of thing. And the people just got right behind him and said, this is ridiculous. How can you not feed the homeless? And as you say, they just went out and just disobeyed it. And that's I've said it all along. People just have to start saying no to all of this stuff.
Yeah.
Just ignore it.
And just to add to that, I just looked it up. It was Fort Lauderdale. So people can look up. RT had a post December of last year. Florida judge lifts ban on feeding homeless in public. So again, people can stand up to these stupid, ridiculous laws. And again, the laws are only as good as the people who believe in them. And if people don't believe in them, and if they do not comply with them, at a certain point, the so-called authorities will have no authority.
Yeah, it's, I mean, one of the ridiculous things that got me here, we've got a gas stove and a gas main's connected up, and we've got to pay, it's got three different people have got to do this job, the meter, run the pipe to the stove and connect it up. You can't even buy the pipe to fit yourself without connecting it, just running the pipe. You're not even allowed to buy it because you're not licensed. That's how ridiculous it's getting. It's like the movie Brazil, you know, you need about four or five different people to do one simple job, which could be done by obviously more or less anybody. Anybody can run a piece of pipe, just roll it out and that's it, you know, but you can't even buy it here because you're not licensed. And those kind of things that you mentioned, legislation, it just has to be ignored. I mean, obviously you don't want to put anybody in danger or anything, but it needs to be ignored, all these ordinances and building regulations. I mean, if you've got qualified builders who know what they're doing, they don't need some guy with a clipboard, a piece of paper telling them they're doing it right. You know, it's not in their interest to build something that's going to fall on somebody, because they're not doing it for this big profit motive and putting the cheapest materials in or anything like that. They're doing it for the right reasons. So they're going to do it properly.
Let's even appeal to the most cynical in the audience, people who say, well, what's wrong with the profit motive and what's wrong with doing this for that reason? Well, okay, even in that case, it's to the advantage of people in a peer-to-peer economy to be as real, as faithful, as true, as honest in their work as they possibly can, because that the reputation of an individual person becomes really their currency. And there's all sorts of examples of this, but even if we look at the eBay phenomenon, that's policed by users themselves who rate the sellers. If someone consistently delivers crap or doesn't deliver on time or doesn't deliver at all, they will have terrible ratings and people will avoid them. If people consistently deliver quality goods like they promised and on time and in the way they promised, they will have good ratings and people will use them. Those are the types of self-policing systems that come in a peer-to-peer economy that can be can subvert the centralized economy, where there are all sorts of ways around that. I mean, a McDonald's or whatever can get away with whatever they want because they have the bajillions of dollars to lobby the government to change the rules in whatever way they need in order to serve their interests. And so we see this corporate lobbying phenomenon. I mean, that's far and away the largest industry in Washington is corporate lobbying, because people know it's a huge return on investment. As long as you get a few Congress critters in your back pocket, you can do all sorts of things that would be impossible otherwise. But in a peer-to-peer economy, there is no centralized location where people lobby to get special rules. It's literally interacting directly with your customers. So even if it is simply for a profit motive, there is still the direct incentive for people to do the best work that they can. But on that note of just not cooperating or not following the arbitrary laws and restrictions that whatever would-be government tries to come in with to try to clamp down on this phenomenon, this is something that I tried to point out in another recent episode of my podcast, How to Free Your Tax Cattle, where I talked about Etienne de Laboetie's Discourse on Voluntary Servitude, which was written in 1576 or published in 1576. So it's nearly 500 years old at this point, but still some very basic and very practical philosophy about why people go along with dictators and how they can subvert the dictator, not by rising up with pitchforks, not by trying to, you know, start some armed revolution, but simply by ignoring the dictates of the dictator. And again, that's a phenomenon that works when enough people actually take place in it. The power of the tyrant is all in the tyrant's mind. So it's an exceptionally important thing to understand, that the power always lies with the people to follow along and to uphold the status quo or to defy it. And there are smarter and less smart ways, I suppose, to defy the status quo. And the question is always how we get from here to there. But in the end, the ultimate ideal society would be a society where people do not take the whims and dictates of people wearing funny hats or badges or sitting in powerful offices halfway around the world. Do not take those for ironclad laws of the universe that must be obeyed, but people actually listen to reason and follow the sort of dictates of their own conscience. And that's, again, that's a long way off, and that sounds very idealistic, but the process of getting from here to there is actually extremely easy, and it involves non-cooperation. And I also gave some examples of non-cooperation in that episode of How to Free Your Tax Cattle, of all sorts of ideas of this phenomenon taking place already. Police in the UK trying to foreclose on a homeowner, hundreds of people, he put out the word on YouTube, hundreds of people gathered and physically stopped the bailiffs from coming to kick him out of his house. Similar process is taking place in Spain. There's the ban on feeding the homeless in Fort Lauderdale, as I say, overturned by the court once enough people started protesting against it. So again, so many different ways that this phenomenon is already happening, and I just hope people realize this is a wave that you can either ride on or you can be subsumed by. So hopefully it's the former rather than the latter.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely non-cooperation with a system that's out to do you harm, basically. So why would you cooperate with it? A colleague of mine and a fellow host here has just mentioned that he's 1 hour from Ozark. So he's going to go up there and check it out. He's a bit of an entrepreneur himself. He makes gemstones out of just stones he finds and polishing them up, and broken crystal glasses and stuff like that. And so he's going to go up there and check that out and maybe come back with some kind of video report on it. And that should be quite interesting. I lost my train of thought there. I was thinking of something else before that went on.
Couldn't have been important.
Possibly not. you mentioned non-cooperation, obviously, and the thing about these ordinances and laws and all the rest of it, most of them are unenforceable. The basic tenet is that if a law is unenforceable, then it's no right being a law anyway, in the first place. I don't see how anybody could stop like a million people in a city from feeding a few homeless people. It's impossible. So the law in itself is ridiculous and worthless. Because there's no basic common sense behind it anyway. I mean, what are you going to be accused of trying to poison the homeless for some reason? I mean, is that the logic behind these kind of laws? You're trying to do harm, because that's the only way it would be a crime.
Well, exactly right. I mean, like all of these laws against victimless crimes, they're only as good as the people who are willing to go along with them. And as you say, there are so many of these unenforceable dictates that really only work because people believe the authority in their head. They go along with it, and they police themselves, basically. Oh, well, I can't do that. If the government says I can't feed the homeless, then I better not do that. Again, there's no way to possibly stop people rising up en masse and doing that. But, people are dissuaded from rising up en masse and doing that simply because they believe the authority, and they believe that voice in their head saying if the government says something, then it must be, you know, ironclad dictate of the universe. So again, I hope people will go and read something like the Discourse on Voluntary Servitude to realize that people have known for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years how to subvert dictators without the pitchforks, without the guns, without the bloodshed. And in fact, it's more effective when it's done without bloodshed, because we all know where those violent revolutions tend to lead, like the French Revolution or what have you. They generally tend to lead to either the same type of dictatorship, just under different guise, or even worse types of tyranny, like we saw with the Reign of Terror under Robespierre. So again, it's. I don't think the answer is going to be in some sort of violent overthrow. I think it's the process of people simply ignoring the dictators and working directly with each other.
Well, absolutely. The dictators have no power unless we give them it and allow them to wield it over us. Just to finish off, you live in Japan. I mean, that's widely regarded as one of the highly technical countries on the planet. Is there much evidence of this peer-to-peer system working there?
It's interesting you bring that up, because certainly, excuse me, I'm losing my voice here, but certainly the idea that a lot of people have is this is an extremely technologically advanced society. And I guess in the sort of, you know, the development, the bowels of the research projects of the various companies, I suppose there is some advanced technology. But in terms of everyday life here, it's really not nearly so as so technologically advanced as people might think. So, I mean, banking and everything is still very much done with paper and pen, more so than it is with computers. So, I wouldn't say there's that degree of detail here, but I think there is a greater degree of community involvement and community and the sense that community is important here than there was in Canada where I'm from. So I think that that is something that hasn't been wrenched out of the Japanese people in the same way that it has been wrenched out of a lot of people in the Western countries. And that's obviously to the credit of a society like this, where there is still that sense that people take care of each other. And that's reflected in a lot of different ways. I mean, you have the phenomenon of parents usually living with their children in the household, even, you know, when their children get old and married. And so you have three generations that will live together and help to take care of the children and things like that. So that, for example, you don't need to send them off to government indoctrination camps from the time they're born and things of that nature. There's also the sort of community, the family farming idea. Every family has a little rice paddy somewhere out in the countryside where they all go to chip in the harvest time to bring in some rice and vegetables and things like that. So there is still that community sense in a society like what we have here in Japan. And I think that's much to the credit, but it's not necessarily a technologically advanced one.
Well, I mean, having said that, I mean, the fact that it is that kind of community already is got to be a good breeding ground for a kind of peer-to-peer economy, because people are already in that mindset.
I think it gives them a head start anyway. And I'm very excited to see how that could play out. But unfortunately, the Japanese have been under imperial conditioning for a very, very long time. That means that a lot of them very much obey authority unquestioningly and will use whatever kind of the default status quo institutions are. So most people will keep their money in their bank account, one of the big banks here, and they will purchase Japanese government bonds as their retirement savings, and that's kind of the way that a lot of people operate. So I think the imperial conditioning needs to be broken out of here, and I think that's going to be the real hurdle. But again, there's all sorts of community organizations that are springing up and ideas that are coming to the fore. So I think it's an exciting time, but again, like any other time in history, it's what we make of it. And if we don't appreciate what is at least possible, then we'll never be able to bring it to fruition.
I couldn't agree with you more. We've got to do something. There's no point sitting back and just watching it all just crumbling around our ears. We're all individual people, and we've all got our own families to look after, and no government is ever going to do that for us. So we've got to do it ourselves in one way or another.
That's it.
Okay. Well, that was a positive note to finish off on, and hopefully we'll have you back on again in the near future.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to it. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thanks very much, James. Cheers.